I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week.
200 years old. Don't look a day over 160, darling.
You are the best. May you have another successful 100 years. This is from Jane Fonda. Hi.
This week, The Guardian turned 200.
So there are not many companies in any business that last for two centuries. And it says something about the role The Guardian plays in the world that it has got this far. I think it's because we know who we are. We have roots. We have principles. We have philosophy. We have values.
To mark the occasion, Global Editor-in-Chief Catherine Viner wrote an essay charting the values that make The Guardian what it is today.
Times change. Technologies change. Principles don't. 200 years, and we've only just begun.
So how have these principles guided Guardian Australia? What impact have we had? And what enemies have we made? Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Political Editor Catherine Murphy about The Guardian's legacy and its impact on Australia. It's Friday, the 7th of April. Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Murph.
Good morning, my dear.
So this week, The Guardian celebrated its 200th anniversary. Where did we start, Lenore?
Yeah, 200 years, huh? Who'd have thunk?
Oh, I know.
So the history of The Guardian traces back to something called the Peterloo Massacre in 1819, which was a big rally in Manchester where people were calling for parliamentary reform as a means to try and better their sort of pretty dire living circumstances. It was a peaceful rally, but the local authorities sort of freaked out, I suppose, because, you know, the French Revolution was only a couple of decades before and they were all very nervous. The cavalry was sent in, completely overreacted. Dozens of people died, hundreds were injured. Those horrible events inspired a young businessman called John Edward Taylor to set up the Manchester Guardian a couple of years later. I can't claim to be an enormous authority on the history of The Guardian, but I guess the point of the story, the reason we tell that origin story, is that our roots, the roots of our organisation, are sort of deep in the need or the idea of changing things and of making the world better. That's where we started. We didn't always stay there. I think we're going to run some stories during this 200th anniversary time about parts of our history where we took the wrong approach or the wrong editorial line. But for the most part, we've been guided by those principles. And particularly when someone called C.P. Scott became editor, I think he was editor from like 1872 to 1929. So he was editor for the 100th anniversary, where he wrote a big essay like our current editor-in-chief, Kath Viner, has done for the 200th anniversary. And in that, he talked about The Guardian having a moral as well as a material existence. So we have a very clear sensibility, a very clear sense of purpose in our roots. And it was exactly that sense of purpose and exactly that idea which certainly inspired me to join The Guardian when we launched in Australia 8 years ago, because I felt very strongly that that was what Australia needed, and another media voice guided by that same sense of purpose. And then when I became editor a couple of years after that, about 5 years ago now, I mean, that's the way I've tried to lead the organisation. I think that sort of compass, that plumb line of knowing why we're here and what we're doing it for is what makes us different.
The point Lenore's touched on is really critically important. And I think the time where we made the decision to join the operation in Australia was a really turbulent one in Australian journalism. It's sort of... Well, Australian journalism's been faced many difficulties since the internet upended everybody's business models. But certainly at the point where we made the decision to come and work for Guardian Australia, I felt purposeless, if I can express it in those terms. The industry was sort of locked in this struggle to make the transition from the newspaper era to the digital era. Nobody was doing it well. there was a sense of flux and a sense of survivalism that trumped the mission, trumped, you know, why we actually do this. And so the opportunity to join a media organisation that was further along the digital transition path than organisations in Australia at the time. So that seemed a bit more settled, if that makes sense.
Mm. And, you know, it was a bit of a leap into the unknown at the time, let's be frank. You know, it was a tiny, tiny startup. We had to make a lot of noise and swing our hands wildly to look bigger than we were. Mm. And it was, as Merv says, a time when the business model was being upended. And, you know, it's been a work in progress since then. Our own business model has changed. But the points I wanted to make about then also was that the concentration of media ownership was then, as it is now, you know, a serious issue for Australian democracy. And certainly one of my motivations was to create a new and independent and fair and fierce editorial voice in Australia to help combat that problem, which I think continues to be a really serious issue. The business model question was also sort of at the forefront. And I think we need to be sort of clear that we've actually changed tack a bit along the lines as well. Like at the time, I guess my operating assumption was that if we could create an Australian outpost, an Australian version of that was attached to a global organisation, that we would be able to exist on advertising revenue. That was the assumption at the time. A little later on, and you know, it was around the time when I took over as editor here, we realised that wasn't actually going to work, and that's when we launched the reader revenue model, which again was a bit of a leap into the unknown. We were asking people to pay us or to give us money because they valued what we do, even though they could get it for free.
Mm.
You know, if you sort of said that in most business schools, I think you were a bit mad.
Yeah.
But actually now 5 years on, that 65% of our revenue is reader revenue.
That's amazing.
God bless our readers.
Yeah.
Thank you, readers. So I think, you know, it's been a real work in progress, but it's always been guided by those very, very clear values and the very, very clear sense of purpose from the start.
One of the lines that really stuck out to me in Kath's essay was that she said, this is what we mean when we say that our purpose is to provide hope through clarity and imagination. Murph, how hard is it to provide hope when you're covering Australian politics day in and day out?
Well, if you don't have hope, Gabby, you need to go and work in a dress shop.
Mm.
You really need to do something other than what we do, because if you reach that point of cynicism where you can't bear it, where you can't bear to look at them, where you can't bear to engage with the national discourse and national affairs, and you think it is all hopeless, then you're actually a corrosive agent in the system as well. You know, sort of tracking back to where this conversation started, we are journalists with purpose. We get out of bed every day, come to work, have the privilege of working in this business because we genuinely believe that we perform a public service and we want to shift the dial and we want to make the world better for our kids and their kids. Now, all that might sound corny or like I'm reading some sort of a PR talking point, but seriously, this is a really tough job. And it involves a lot of combat, lots of direct combat with quite powerful people. It involves a lot of truth-telling, which can be very hard in close proximity because I don't cover politics from a distance. I cover politics within eyeball to eyeball with the most powerful people in the country. And you've got to be prepared to say when they get it wrong, when they're idiots, when they do something that's decidedly not in the national interest. And anybody who says that's an easy job is lying to you. It's really hard.
And I think it goes to what we mean when we say that we're progressive. That isn't a term implying partisanship in any way. It's a term which means that we think that the world can be better, and we think that being informed by factual and clear journalism, that can help the world be better. That's what we mean by being progressive. And I think that goes also to sort of an understanding of how we look at pluralism and what constitutes partisanship, because as Murph says, I think that's been warped in recent years a bit by the misinformation and the hyper-partisanship of the debate. So, you know, balance does not mean that you are criticised or lauded equally by both sides of a debate. It means you go wherever your responsible reporting takes you. It means you go wherever the facts take you. And I think the climate debate is a really good example of that. Because the government for more than a decade now has not had a coherent climate policy, we've had to say that again and again and again. I said it for the 3 years that I was political editor, and when I appointed Merv to that job when I became editor, she said it many times as well. That's not an expression of partisanship on our part. That is us calling the policy with a deep understanding of it for what it is. And I think it's important to understand that if there's parts of the discussion, parts of the debate that are sort of pulling, stretching credulity out to one side, you might not end up in the middle while still following the plumb line of factual and conscientious reporting. And it's always important to orientate yourself by that plumb line, and that's what we do.
One of the things the Guardian's published this week is some tributes from editors around the world. And one that really I liked was from Ian Katz, who's also a former Guardian editor, who wrote, "The measure of a paper's true independence is the range and power of the enemies it makes. The Guardian has amassed a formidable and formidably eclectic collection of them over 200 years. Has Guardian Australia made powerful enemies?"
Oh, yeah. Do you want to start, Murph, or shall I?
No, Lenore, you seem fired up. You start. I'll fill in the blanks. How's that? I'll fill in the blanks.
Oh, God. Well, I do remember back in the early days when people were sort of a little bit discombobulated by our sort of muscular entry into the scene, that the Abbott government tried for a while to not send us any press releases, not tell us when any press conferences were on, and basically try to sort of, you know, cold shoulder us out of existence, which didn't work at all. And so eventually they just kind of, you know, well, they didn't quite, they were never entirely friendly, but they just sort of gave up on that campaign. But they were taken aback, I think, that we were so overt in our analysis from the start. So I guess that was one example. Where would you go, Murph?
Well, yeah, it was certainly that was a character forming period, shall we say, to quote the great Michelle Grattan. But actually, a fun period.
We did have fun.
We really did have fun. We were hysterical a lot of the time, but we did have a lot of fun, and we kicked indoors, and we enjoyed doing it.
We also shared a desk, like literally, like bottom cheek to bottom cheek, because we couldn't get an office in Parliament House.
Well, lucky COVID wasn't around in those times.
No, exactly.
Yeah, there was no social distancing.
No social distancing in the back office of Channel 10, let me tell you. Now, these days, the difference between the period where Lenore served as political editor, which was really our entry and consolidation, to now, which is the sort of growth period of the organisation, is the Guardian, at least in Canberra, is now a very fixed part of the firmament. Like, it's sort of,
I'd like to think it's a fixed part of the firmament Australia-wide.
Yes, like we're here. Everybody knows we're here, even if they would like to ignore us. And periodically they still do, or exclude us, or play silly games. We are now large enough to where ignoring is just kind of ridiculous. Mm. Mainly we have constructive dealings in Canberra, and we work very hard to keep things on a constructive plane. But there are certain ministers, Peter Dutton being the real standout, who don't really engage with The Guardian and haven't since the start. But by and large, we are in a quantifiably different place than where we started.
And the thing that I also find gratifying is that we've proven that it actually doesn't matter, that old sort of type of journalism where you were reliant on some sort of, you know, give and take relationship and the drops from ministerial offices is kind of, yes, is passé. We don't need it. In lots of ways, we're better off without it.
Mm. Yes, I agree with that. I think it's obviously still part of the culture here, and we engage with it to the extent that we need to in order to keep readers informed. But it doesn't define our purpose.
No.
And that's really, I know it's important to Lenore, it's very important to me too, to have that sense that in terms of our political coverage, we identify issues that are important for reasons that we yeah. identify objectively and factually. We prosecute these issues whether they're top of the agenda or not, and we persist.
Mm. And we did that from the start. You know, from the very beginning, we identified the issues that we thought were underreported and that where we wanted to make a difference, and that was the climate emergency, the treatment of asylum seekers, Indigenous issues,
yep.
The environment more broadly, politics more broadly, welfare policy. You know, as editor, I feel sort of proudest in some ways of a lot of the work we've done, which has given voice to the recipients of NDIS payments or welfare payments who... You know, there was a whole tradition of journalism writing about people rather than listening to them. So that's a whole sort of switch in attitude almost. So we've identified our priorities and we've done things differently and we've done it, you know, really quite deliberately.
I wonder if we can recap some of Guardian Australia's highlights. I think we started with a huge scoop about spying.
There was the revelations about the spying on the Indonesian president and his wife, which was quite a wild ride. It was very early on. It was part of the Snowden revelations. It involved sort of clandestine meetings with intelligence officials. And I do believe that we were called traitors in the parliament for running this story.
We were.
It was, and News Corp staked out our sad little office to try to take a picture of the editor-in-chief, Kath Viner, for what was it, Murph, like most of a day?
Yeah, it was quite something. It really was all day, I think. Yes, we were sort of semi-barricaded in this office.
And the government was also quite shocked in the 2014 budget when we expected them to be fair.
I remember that budget was just, I kept looking like, they can't be doing that. Oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord. So we just called it, like, this budget is not fair. And I think because it was the new government, a lot of media organisations were saying that it was the sort of the fiscal pain that was needed for the national gain. And I think we just looked at it and said, no, you know, even if you want to make spending cuts, these are the among the unfairest ways that you
could possibly do it.
Could possibly do it. And actually, public opinion agreed with us.
I remember I hadn't started yet and seeing that coverage, seeing The Guardian being the only newspaper saying how unfair it was, I was like, I have got to get a job there. And you also mentioned Indigenous Affairs. We've done some really groundbreaking stuff with our Indigenous Affairs editor, Lorena Allam.
Absolutely. So the Deaths Inside database and the massacre map were two things that call the Killing Times that I would mention. Both of those sort of stand as pieces of research that are constantly referred back to that have influenced the debate. The Deaths Inside database calculated the number of Indigenous deaths in custody since the Royal Commission and was inspired by the fact that when one of our reporters went to try and find out that fact, they realised that the data did not exist, despite one of the recommendations of the Royal Commission being that that data should exist. And so we set about compiling it, and it was a very, very long and laborious task. But now that number is the number that is on the placards at Black Lives Matter rallies that is constantly referred to. And I think it is that sort of benchmarking data journalism that has really, you know, made a difference in those discussions.
We don't want to be too self-congratulatory. Is there anything, Murph, that we've got wrong?
It's really important to highlight this, I think, for listeners, Gabby, because it's sort of one of those things where I think part of the reason that we have been adopted by Australian readers and embraced by Australian readers is that they trust us. And that means when we get things wrong, we acknowledge it. We do it quickly. I was hired at the beginning of the operation as the political live blogger, and I made it an absolute matter of practice that if I got something wrong, I would correct it very, very quickly, and that the correction would be prominent so that readers would understand that we're not perfect, we're not brilliant, we don't leap out of bed every morning and have the absolute perfect wisdom on everything and get every factual point right. Sometimes we do stuff up. Mm. And there can be a reluctance in some media organisations to correct errors because it's sort of, it's a sign of weakness or you just want the cycle to move on past or whatever you do. I think, again, I feel very lucky to work here because when we do get it wrong, and we do, I've got facts wrong and had to correct them, particularly in the live phase because everything moves so quickly. You know, sometimes I've had a view on something that I've later adjusted in the light of subsequent evidence or because I've reflected on it a bit more. Again, I just feel very lucky to work in an organisation where self-reflection is not only encouraged, it's mandatory. It's not, we don't, you know, erect statues to ourselves in this organisation. We don't walk around thinking
didn't
that we're
perfect.
Didn't
I tell you I'd commissioned the bust, Mer?
That's our secret, Lenore. Don't tell anyone.
But oh, I bow to it every day.
But on that, though, I think it does raise an interesting point about the relationship with readers and listening to readers and the tensions that sometimes arise as the debate becomes more partisan. And if I can hark back to good old C.P. Scott, who said, "The voice of opponents, no less than of friends, has a right to be heard," which is a sort of an article of faith for us. Mm. But that is sometimes a difficult road to stride when sometimes our friends, sometimes people who agree with us, don't always like it when we look at alternative points of view, when we give voice to others. That is our mandate and we will continue to do that. And I think that's a... I don't think it's something we get wrong. I'm not saying that, but I do think it is sometimes a point of tension. It's something that as editor, I have to sort of really think about as the debate becomes more and more polarised.
So where to next?
Okay, so we want to grow. We want to be a place where there are jobs for journalists to do innovative, groundbreaking, important journalism. And the good news is, we are growing. We've now got 104 staff and 70 of those are in editorial. I mean, when you think back to our early days, I wouldn't have even dreamed of that. And we're continuing to grow. So I think that we are already, and we will become even more, a solid, influential part of the Australian debate. It's going to sound slightly self-congratulatory, but I do think that the Australian debate, the Australian discourse is deeper and broader and better for the fact that we are here. I think we've influenced the national debate on the climate emergency and the treatment of asylum seekers and Indigenous issues and politics. And I think that as we grow, we are really now solid and present and part of the Australian media landscape, and we're here for good and we're going to grow bigger. And I want us, as editor, I want us to be more influential, not in a I want to wield the power kind of way, but because I think the ideas and the values that we represent exert influence for the good in Australia.
Next, a fun photograph and a serious systemic issue. Lenore, what story could you not get out of your head this week?
Okay, I'm going to seem slightly trite this week.
Well, it's usually Mike, so it's your turn.
But I just couldn't get that photograph out of my head of the Bidens kneeling down beside Jimmy and Rosalind Carter. It's one of those things, you know, I look at it, I've looked at it 10 times and I laugh every time. And not in a mean way, it's just the angle of the camera means that the Bidens look like they're like 4 times bigger than the Carters. And it's just, there's something inherently comical about it, even though it was a lovely shot and it was really sweet and nice, just is really funny. And we got our photographic editor to explain in photographic terms why the photo turned out like that. So we weren't being mean, really.
No, there was this phrase that she said, the reason it looks like a doll's house, and now every time I look at the photo, I just,
See,
it just does look at it like a doll's house.
Yeah, I think the story, to just bring it down a bit, that I can't get out of my head this week, is just Ben Smee's reporting on domestic violence and Queensland Police's response. It's just harrowing, actually, and the lack of willingness to admit that there might be a cultural problem is
astounding.
There's
just systemic failure there to deal with it properly. He's been doing such a good job.
Well, thank you once again, Lenore, for that wonderful conversation.
Thanks, Gabs.
Thanks so much for listening and bearing with us for this brief moment of self-reflection. This episode was produced by Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. I hope you have a great weekend. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.